Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm Paul David, founder and CEO of Literal Humans. And I'm joined today by Julio Martinez Clark, co-founder and CEO of BioAccess. And we're talking about accelerating medtech innovation and first in human success. Welcome to the pod, Julio.
Thank you, Paul. I look forward to our conversation today.
Of course, of course. So I want to introduce BioAccess to our audience here. It's the world's first contract research organization, or CRO, that's purpose-built specifically for first-in-human, or FIH, clinical trials. They help medtech, biopharma, and radiopharma startups bridge the gap between prototype and clinical data. Julio is a seasoned entrepreneur and industry thought leader who spent over 15 years helping companies navigate the complexities of the Latin American healthcare market. From hosting the Global Trial Accelerators podcast to leading Synapse Global Theranostics, he is a true pioneer in democratizing access to life-saving medical innovation. Thank you for all the work you've done, Julio, and welcome to the pod.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me here again, and look forward to sharing my experience with your audience and having a fun conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It must be Health Tech Day as well, because I was just talking about, just had someone in who was doing reviews for consumer health products and trying to make them verified and helping brands just like strengthen the reviews, because a lot of people depend on those. So we'll connect you to at some point, because it might be there. Yeah.
Excellent.
So first question, we'd like to just sort of go over the landscape and describe the landscape that you're working in for our audience. There's this concept of the valley of death, and so we need to explain that to our audience. And it you know, claims somewhere around 90% of healthcare startups. And you've mentioned that a lot of these startups, they don't fail because their tech doesn't work, but because they run out of capital before getting to that clinical data. So how does BioAccess help them solve this time to data problem? And what led you to kind of create like this sort of new category in clinical research focused on FIH trials?
Well, first of all, Paul, it's important to give the audience context here. Or medical innovation starts usually at universities, either in the US or the UK and some other countries in Europe. And there are entrepreneurs who license these intellectual property or patents from universities. The university ecosystem in the US and many parts of Western Europe is really designed to spur innovation, to bring innovation to market. And they receive a lot of funds from the government and private donors to create labs and to innovate, to either, in the case of medical innovation, they either create molecules for new drugs or devices, new technologies. So there are entrepreneurs out there that who identify these breakthrough innovations, and they create companies, startup companies, 3 to 5 people that are designed to advance that innovation, to develop that innovation with the ultimate goal to exit, to sell the company, which is in the financial world, in the venture capital world, in the private equity world, is called an exit. It's a liquidity event, right? You create a company with an end in mind, which is usually to sell the company to a larger player in the industry. In the case of the medical device industry or biotech industry, the big guys, Pfizer, Merck, Novartis, Abbott, Johnson & Johnson, Medtronic, Boston Scientific, etc. So with that said, it's important also to understand that for you to develop medical innovation, this is a very capital-heavy industry. For you to develop a product, a molecule, or a device, you need a lot of money, and you need talent. You need experts, professionals, world-class people, and you go to investors. So investors give you money, but they want something in return, right? It's obvious. So you create a plan for your investors. So you have to basically answer a few questions to them. Like the first question an investor has in their head is, how much money do I have to put in? How much money am I going to get out? And when I'm going to get it out, right? So you create a plan to get that money out, which is the exit that you're planning, which is, again, is the sale of your company to a third party. So the point is that you have investors breathing down your neck for results. So you receive money from them, and they give you a time limit for them to receive that money back. So that concept is really important to understand the speed of these. They really, really need to get to certain milestones. And the first human clinical trial is that first milestone that they need to reach before they move on to a larger clinical trial, so that the FDA or the European Medicine Agency gives them the approval, and or they get acquired by a larger company. So that period where they got the money and they don't have clinical data, that's called the valley of death, because they need to prove that the innovation works, is meaning that it's safe and eventually efficacious in humans, so that they can raise more money and or can sell the company to investors. So that period may last many months or many years.
And is the goal where they go to their
clinical trial.
And is the goal to like both shorten that period and also increase their chances of making it through? Yeah.
Yes. Because it's also important to understand something called the burn rate that these companies have. As I said, this is a very capital heavy industry where you have to pay high salaries, you have to pay high fees to any third party vendors, etc. So the burn rate, the average burn rate of these companies is anywhere between $300,000 to $400,000 every month. Every month. So imagine how expensive it is to run these companies. So every day that you are not moving the needle or moving things forward,
I mean, what a massive opportunity for you all to demonstrate to these companies and also to funders, like, hey, we can save you, you know, potentially millions on a daily basis. That's fascinating. So
if we save them 3 months, 6 months, that's a lot of money.
It's easier for y'all to quantify the value, the ROI of working with you. Great segue. Let's jump into your product and talk about, you've got this innovation runway and you've been able to compress clinical timelines by 40%, I think is the figure that we've seen.
Yes.
Talk us through it and help, you know, help us understand how it manages to get, you know, kind of approval and I think somewhere in the range of 4 to 8 weeks versus months. Help us understand like the specific advantages of working with treatment naive, I think is the term, cohorts in Latin America for these early stage trials.
Yes. Well, we've been in this industry for about 20 years now, and we've developed a large network of hospitals and investigators in Latin America. We probably have the largest network in the medical device industry and also the biotech industry. But we have found that time is really of the essence for this company. Time is really the reason these companies talk to us at BioAccess. They are always looking to, as I said, to save time so that they don't burn as much cash as if they were doing the trial in other geographies. So we have understood that we have to deliver on our promise of saving them time with their site activation. Meaning, site activation meaning that if you identify an individual, a physician in a country that has the patient recruitment capabilities that you need for your product, for the trial you're looking to run or to execute, then you need to go through certain steps to activate that investigator at that specific site. So you really activate a team, you activate a hospital from the regulatory standpoint. There is a lot of red tape, there's a lot of documentation, there's a lot of letters and signatures and things that need to happen before you officially activate a site to start a trial. So that's really the day zero, the activation. So site activation is really what these companies are looking to do fast. And of course, patient recruitment, which happens after site activation. And for site activation to happen, you need to have regulatory approval processes that are efficient, that are predictable and fast. So we've done trials pretty much all over Latin America. So we have found places, meaning countries and hospitals, that are very friendly to these type of clinical trials. And the type of clinical trial we're talking about here is not a traditional vaccine trial that people saw in the news during the pandemic, or the GLP-1 trials that are larger trials, etc. We're talking about first-in-human trials. First-in-human trials is the first experience that company has testing the device in a live patient, live human patient. And that's usually called phase one, but in medical device terminology, it's called first-in-human. So we have found places around Latin America where we can get these sites activated really, really quickly in countries that are friendly to these trials. For example, in Panama, Panama is very much friendly to attracting clinical research. There is a whole initiative backed by the Panamanian government to attract clinical research. El Salvador is another country. Mexico is another country, et cetera, et cetera. So that's really how we can accelerite the path to site activation and patient recruitment for these companies.
And it's a great segue into kind of, you know, aspects of your growth strategy that I kind of wanted to understand. Be remiss if we didn't ask about that. We're a growth consultancy here. And
yeah,
want to understand, you know, you're asking folks to kind of, you know, strategically leverage the Latin American market to kind of de-risk their path to,
yes,
you know, getting through clinical trials and then eventually to exit. I want to understand, you know, for your end on your growth strategy, how do you approach site selection? That's one question I had. And then how do you talk to investors who maybe they're skeptical that, you know, lower cost doesn't actually mean lower quality in a Latin American clinical setting? And how do you navigate those potential roadblocks as part of your growth strategy?
Yeah. Well, site selection is a process where we interview a whole bunch of investigators, potential investigators or candidate investigators for that specific trial that we're looking to conduct in a country. So what we do is we take the what is called the protocol, the research protocol from the client, the sponsor of the clinical trial, and then we put together what in the industry is called a feasibility questionnaire, which is basically a 2 or 3 page questionnaire where the sponsor asks questions to the candidate investigator. It's like instead of having an interview when you're applying for a job, they send you a list of questions and you reply to the question, you complete the questionnaire before they actually interview you. So that's how it works. So we send out a broadcast email to our network and they reply saying, yes, we're interested in that trial. We want to participate in that innovation. We want to publish the results. We want to be part of it. We have the patient recruitment capabilities that you guys need. And then we receive their answers. Then we interview them. We coordinate the meeting between after the interview that we do internally with the potential investigator to confirm everything in the feasibility questionnaire. Then we coordinate a meeting with between the investigator and the sponsor of the clinical trial, the client. And then we filter down the list to just a handful of potential sites out of many. And then we go and visit these facilities, meet the investigator, we meet the staff, we tour the facility, we make sure they have the right equipment, et cetera, et cetera. And then we officially make a determination and we send them out either a rejection or an acceptance letter.
And what specifically makes it more affordable, more effective? Is it just like purchasing power parity, you know, currency difference? Like how do you actually bring down the cost and increase the speed?
Yes. Well, the speed is because we know what countries are fast to approve these type of trials. For example, if you go to Colombia right now, Colombia is not the best country to get its trials approved. Mexico is not so fast either, although it's a huge country because of the large population. But we usually start in Panama, El Salvador, in the Dominican Republic, in Chile, Paraguay, even Brazil. Brazil just changed the law. So it's really, really fast to approve trials now. So we start with a handful of countries that we know that we can work with those ethics committees, IRB, institutional review boards, and regulatory agencies and Ministry of Health that are going to work with us to get these trials approved fast. If for some reason we cannot get the trial approved because it's difficult to recruit that type of patients in that specific country, then we go to another location like Mexico or Argentina or Colombia. So the point is that we already know where to go to get trials approved fast. And also the clinical data that was part of your prior question is we make sure trials are conducted following international guidelines, ICH-GCP, which is the international guideline to conduct clinical research around the world. And that's actually a prerequisite from the FDA and the European Medicine Agency that trials are run following international guidelines. Otherwise, they won't accept the data or investors won't accept the data either. So when we talk to our clients, they need to feel confident that we as a contract research organization are selected for them a site, an investigator that is properly trained in international guidelines for clinical research.
Really interesting. And talk us through your growth strategy. Like, how are you? Have you raised? Are you, you know, pre-revenue, post-revenue? How are you thinking about 2026, the remainder of the year, in terms of scaling into, you know, new clients, new customers, new countries? Just give us the roadmap for growth for BioAccess.
Yeah, well, we're self-funded. We keep reinvesting the profits of the company. We've been profitable for many years. We have different revenue for our size. And the growth trajectory for BioAccess is eventually to get acquired by a larger contract research organization, probably from the United States or Europe. There are groups that are putting together what is called platform investment companies that are acquiring what in the financial terminology is called add-ons. Add-ons meaning smaller companies in a fragmented market to build a larger company that consolidates an industry, right? So there are companies like Veranex, Avenia, RQM Plus. These are private equity-backed platform investment companies, and they are actively acquiring add-ons. So we're in the process of talking to a lot of them in the past 2 or 3 years. The conversations have picked up exponentially. Every week, every 2 weeks or so, I have a conversation with either a private equity group, an investment bank, or a platform company, because they are interested more and more in Latin America and what we're doing here at BioAccess, because we created a category, we created a niche.
I think from there we can move into just your experience as a founder. We'd like to hear, you know, founder stories and understand how your background has influenced how you're leading your current company. You know, you've got this incredible career. You've helped over 58 companies grow from seed stage to Fortune 500. So we'd love to talk to you about that offline, because I feel like we have lots to learn from you. Would love to understand, like, you know, based on what you see, you probably see a lot of folks making mistakes, you know, but also doing great things. What are some of the most common strategic mistakes that you see, you know, med tech or health tech founders broadly make, you know, when they're kind of planning their initial, you know, clinical strategy, their growth strategy? Would love to kind of, because you've had all these interesting advisory roles, you know, what are you seeing out there, and what would you sort of advise founders on as they're scaling?
Specifically, founders of med tech and or biotech companies, we see a lot of new CEOs, meaning, remember that I mentioned that usually these innovations come from universities in the United States or Western Europe. So usually a PhD student who participated in the development of that intellectual property in a lab is the founder of the spin-off company from that university. So it's a new founder, PhD graduate, science focus, not necessarily business savvy, and he needs a lot of hand-holding, a lot of advice. So he or she makes a lot of mistakes, obviously. All of us will make if we were in the same position. But one of the mistakes that I see happening is that they hear somebody saying, it just happened to us a month or so ago with a client. We have this new founder, and he's also a PhD graduate. He participated in the development of the innovation in the university lab. And then somebody told him that this great investigator, this awesome physician with great techniques in Ecuador. And we've never done a trial in Ecuador. So we said, sure, we can execute a trial in Ecuador. It's not a country where companies usually go to for clinical research, but we can certainly help you in Ecuador. We can find somebody in Ecuador to who is on the ground to help us with the local matters related to the approval of the trial. And we're happy that you already have selected a potential investigator. So then when we interview that investigator, we realized that that guy was totally clueless about clinical research, had no training, no experience, no infrastructure, no anything. So the fact that somebody knows XYZ doctor in Ecuador doesn't mean that he is the right investigator. So I mean, founders usually go for what's familiar, and that's usually a mistake. So most of our clients, they leave it up to us to find that investigator, because we are the experts. We've been, as I said, we've been doing this for 20 years. What is your site? We have developed this expertise and skill to really find the right persons, the right investigators to lead trials. And we know what questions to ask and how to select them. So yeah, that's a common mistake.
And would love to just ask you this sort of final question about your experience. I'm a fellow writer. I'm working on some books. I know you took sabbatical to write La Cebolla de Pandora. And I'm trying to get that pronunciation right. We talked about that. I'll send this to my partner, Moni. She's gonna love it. And you were exploring evolutionary changes in the human species. How did that period of reflection and writing change your perspective on healthcare and med tech? Very curious to see, you know, what you came back to after that.
Yeah, that's an awesome question, Paul. I think I've been through a transformational period of my life, and that's what led me to write Cebolla de Pandora. And I keep doing the same effort in a different manner, in a different expression, but it's a constant effort to disseminate information that very few people know about, that I think is going to help them transform their lives, just as that information transformed my life. And I took action on that information. So I think the biggest understanding after writing Cebolla de Pandora and all the events that follow after that is the understanding that it's not really about the money. It's not really when I sign up a new client for BioAccess, I'm not necessarily happy for the money. Yeah, the money may be decent. We pay employees, they have better lives. I'm a simple guy. I don't drive BMWs or anything like that. I take the train. So it's not about the money. It's more about helping patients live better lives. That's really my driver. When I sign a new client and I know that that trial is going to happen, for example, in my home country, in Colombia, because it's the country that I go to the most, because my mother lives there, my brother lives there. So I go to Colombia a lot and I see the poverty, I see the struggle, I see how difficult it is for Colombians to access the healthcare system. This is a spread all over Latin America. It's not only a Colombian thing. So I see the struggle and I see the lines as hospitals. I mean, three blocks, people waiting in line from 5 in the morning to get a medication or something. And I've been involved in the implantation of experimental devices for many years. I usually go to all of them. I'm actually going to El Salvador tomorrow to implant devices on patients. So the impact on their lives is so fascinating. I mean, when you see their smiles when they get out of the operating room, when you see the faces of their family, the family members. So it's because they're usually of lower income origins, so they really need to participate in a trial because it's really the only option for them to have access to advanced healthcare, to quality healthcare with compassion. And because we send them Uber drivers to pick them up, the patient and the family members to come to the hospital, they spend the whole day in the hospital doing tests, etc., the procedure, whatever, the follow-up visits. We treat them with dignity, like royalty. We give them meals. We give them some money to compensate for the work that they're skipping or missing, things like that. So this is part of the clinical trial budget. I mean, it's incorporated in the budget, and the sponsor is happy to pay for that. It's happy to pay for any adverse events that happen. I mean, we really, really take care of these families and these patients. And my satisfaction is to see their smiles, to see that we impacted positively the lives of many, many people in a country, in a developing country like Colombia.
That's
And that patient had access to a medical innovation that otherwise wouldn't be available in the country if it wasn't for the trial.
I
Even if
love
it is 5 patients.
so much of what you just said. I mean, I love the word dignity. I feel like the word dignity doesn't get used enough, like when we're talking about people and you know, outcomes and sectors like med tech, health tech, every sector. I love that you keyed in on that. And even though you serve kind of like a B2B, you know, structure, you're thinking about that end user and you're treating them as well. You're addressing them.
Exactly.
That's really powerful. And also as you're talking about, you know, your broader strategy, you're moving, I think the geographic boundaries should not be a barrier to medical breakthroughs, but also having access to quality, you know, quality care, quality
Exactly.
products. Um, and,
Absolutely.
and, and you're literally, I mean, not to, you know, blow smoke, but like you're saving lives because you're accelerating the delivery of life-saving technology, and that's incredible. So,
Exactly. And the reason why these companies are funded, Paul, just to complement, is because there is nothing available for these type of patients. Because for the investor perspective, the market is so huge that nobody has addressed that specific medical need for that patient population. So when we come into a country with a device, with experimental device, it's the only device available in the world, probably, very likely, or usually that's how it is, that is created to treat that specific condition. So we're really making an impact.
And you're what you're getting at there too is like you're solving, you know, structural market failures. you know, in the med tech market. And I think that's incredible. Like that's, you know, you're the way you've got it at the human level, you've got it at the sort of B2B level, and then structurally you're doing a huge service. So yeah, just really want to thank you for what you do. And tell our audience, you know, we'll have to wrap it up there, but tell our audience, like, where can they learn more about BioAccess and how can they get involved? How can they, you know, find you and support?
Well, just Google BioAccess, CRO, Latin America. You're going to be able to find us very easily. We have a very active blog, so that makes us easy to find online. I'm also very active on LinkedIn. Just look for BioAccess. Just look for Julio Martinez Clark. You're going to be able to find me. I'm very approachable. My email's there. My phone number's there. WhatsApp me. Text me. Email me, whatever.
No, I love that. And I love that. It's great to meet founders who are, they're accessible. You know, I think it's easy for founders. Yeah. They hide behind a wall of assistance.
No.
Yeah. No, that's great. That's great. Listen, it's been great having you on the show with us, Julio. And we'd love to, you know, stay in touch. And if there's any way we can support, we're here for you. And for our listeners, thank you. This has been another great episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Little Humans. Joined today by Julio Martinez Clark, the co-founder and CEO of BioAccess. They're doing incredible work accelerating and first-in-human clinical trials. We thank you for what you're doing, and keep on keeping on. We're so grateful for it.
Thanks for having me here, Paul. My pleasure.
Of course. Please, audience, give this episode a review. I'm sure you loved what Julio had to say. So in order to keep that going and get more amazing founders like Julio, please give us a rating. Thanks, everybody. Have a good one.